from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 1 week from today, October 17th, the U.S. Treasury warns this country is headed for default. No debt ceiling raised, no cash to cover all the country's bills. We've been here before, took a hit last time, even with a last-minute deal, lost the country's AAA credit rating. This time, with politics all locked up, it could be far worse. Economic catastrophe, many say. The Tea Party says not to worry. This hour On Point, default scenarios for the country and the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you unfazed, freaking out, feeling like Thelma and Louise, assuming it will all get worked out somehow? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll be joined in a bit by the Financial Times chief economics writer Martin Wolf for a global view of the big U.S. game of chicken, maybe. But first, a big American fiscal conservative economist and a player who's been there in the heat of battle. Alan Auerbach joins us from California, professor of economics and law at the University of California, Berkeley, director of the Birch Center for Tax Policy and Public Finance. He has served as deputy chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, a fiscal hawk. Alan Auerbach, welcome. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
And with us from Chicago, Austin Goolsbee, professor of economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He was chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors from 2010 to 2011, the year of the last debt ceiling crisis and near default. Austin Goolsbee, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You've been there. You were there in the thick of it last time. We'll talk about that. Alan Auerbach, first to you. You care a lot about debt and deficit. What about default? Do you see it as a big deal, a catastrophe, no big deal? You know right now from Washington, we're hearing all of those themes.
I do see it as a big deal. And I should also clarify that my concern about, I guess you could call me a fiscal hawk, but my concerns about fiscal policy really relate to our long-term fiscal imbalances.
Sure.
I think our current policies, which are focusing on the short term, and the game of chicken we're playing right now make no sense at all, and I'm very concerned that we're on a path to, really a damaging economic event.
It is easy for Americans to hear on all kinds of media these days, Republican Tea Party people saying it's not a big deal, don't be fooled. What do you say to that, Professor Auerbach?
Well, I don't see how the largest economy in the world defaulting on its national debt isn't a big deal. This is likely to raise the U.S. government's borrowing rate, lead to a severe loss of credibility that the U.S. government can deal with the important issues it faces, not just on budget issues, but other issues. I mean, if the U.S. government can't handle this issue, then why should our allies around the world think that we can deal with other important questions?
Austin Goolsbee, listen to the range of things that people are hearing just in the last few days. Here's the president at his press conference on Tuesday saying default would be a huge problem.
A decision to actually go through with it, to actually permit default, according to many CEOs and economists, would be, and I'm quoting here, insane, catastrophic, chaos. These are some of the more polite words. Warren Buffett likened default to a nuclear bomb. A weapon too horrible to use.
Insane, catastrophic chaos, a nuclear bomb. But here's Republican Congressman Steve King from Iowa just yesterday on CNN. No big deal.
I think there's not an emergency on the debt ceiling. We are spending less than 10% of our revenue to service our debt. And this alarm about default is just false.
Austin Goolsbee, don't be alarmed or, nuclear bomb.
Well, look. Welcome to crazy town, where we're living, and people are saying, oh, well, U.S. government's going to not pay its bills, and that's not going to have a negative impact on the economy is totally nuts. Look, one of two things is going to happen when they hit the debt ceiling and then they run out of whatever cash they have on hand. Either A, Jack Lew is correct that they are not able to prioritize the payments, meaning the government's run rate is probably 30-35% above what revenue comes in. And what Representative King is saying there is, well, why don't we just pledge that we're going to take all of the tax revenue that comes in, and the first thing we're going to do with it is pay the bondholders. Therefore, we'll never default on Treasury bonds.
So okay. no default because we'll pay the interest, we'll pay the bondholders,
yeah, we'll
so technically we'd be fine.
That's what he said.
Except that nobody's getting their X, Y, or Z checks.
So right, right. Exactly right. So there's two things. So the first is Treasury has said they don't have legal authority to choose between some types of payments and others, that nobody is in the language of finance. Nobody's senior to anybody else. And therefore, anybody who wasn't paid would immediately sue and say, you have no right to pay the bondholders and not pay us. But the second is, even if you were able to pay the bondholders, so you avoided having a catastrophic financial meltdown, there would be a gigantic decrease in the money that the government's sending out to Social Security, to the military, to your grandma in a nursing home. All of those things would stop. And there is a 100% certainty that we would instantly be thrown into a very deep, horrible recession. You'd have a cut to government spending of 35% in a one-day period. And this is so ridiculous to have a conversation about. I don't even know where to begin. We should be having a discussion about long-run fiscal challenges facing the country. We should. But we should not be having a discussion about would it be that bad if we start defaulting on our domestic obligations. I mean, it's like I said, welcome to crazy town.
Alan Auerbach, Social Security payments and so on are one thing. Then there's talk of all this economic knock-on effect, the catastrophe that some in Wall Street and around the world are talking about. There's a lot of maybe whistling past the graveyard in Washington, but maybe it covers concern. Word out today that Republicans may unveil a six-week borrowing limit increase for time to talk about this. But if that, we don't know. This lockup has been a very unusual lockup in Washington in the last couple of weeks here. If we don't get out of it, how do you see the economic potential consequences of default, Alan?
Well, I agree with Austin. First of all, one has to predict what the Treasury will do. We're talking about things that are just close to unthinkable, but if it really happens and we have sharp cuts in Social Security payments and other payments that the government is obliged by law to make and nevertheless won't make, that there'll be a significant negative shock to the economy. We've been talking, we economists anyway, have been talking for a long time about the weakness of the current economic recovery. This will certainly not help. It'll cut GDP growth by a lot over the next few quarters. So we're going to have very negative economic effects in the U.S. That's not going to be good for other countries as well, which I'm sure we'll be talking about later. These are all things that one could say, well, this is too terrible to imagine, so Congress will surely come up with a solution. The kind of solution they're talking about now, which is a very short-term extension of funding and the debt limit, is hardly a very good solution. That just puts off for a few weeks the crisis that we're coming up to right now. And there's no reason to believe from recent discussions in Washington that they're likely to come to any kind of long-term solution.
Now, listeners, depending on where you're hearing this, we may have that kind of six-week extension by this evening from House Republicans. A lot of talk about that as we're on the air. That may be a fact by this very evening. But Austin Goolsbee, what about the Alan Auerbach says, even if we get that 6 week extension, we're throwing such a kind of a ringer into international confidence that we could still send things skittering. Yes or no?
Almost certainly, yes. The only reason I hesitate a little is this is the, you remember the old movie, The Godfather, and he comes in, he said, why did you order the hit on our people? He says, you don't know, and don't ask me, this is the business we've chosen. You know, in some ways, Congress and the confrontations with the president has established a pattern that they're not actually trying. There was a brief moment where they were debating a grand bargain about long-run fiscal responsibility, but they've now avoiding all pretense of that. So this kick the can for between 1 month to 6 months and try to revisit and have the same brouhaha again and again. That's sort of the treadmill we're on.
You were there last time in 2011. Could we not, in 6 weeks, work out a grand bargain that would go to Alan Auerbach and many others' long-term concerns about U.S. debt that would, I mean, President Obama himself says he'd like to do a number of things about that. Republicans talk about the deficit a lot. Isn't 6 weeks enough? Isn't it obvious enough what we might, in a level-headed way, do in 6 weeks?
I would distinguish only between can and will. Could we, in 6 months, come up with a long-run plan like that? Sure, we could. I don't anticipate that happening because once the negotiations about the grand bargain begin, we will return to where we were the last time they fell apart, which is you follow the Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission or any of the other broad approaches. They say you got to hit some target amount of deficit reduction, and you do that with some cuts and some new revenues. And then Republicans say, well, we don't want any new revenues. And then the Democrats will say, well, if you have no revenues, we're not going to do the cuts. And then the thing goes around and around and falls apart. And then they extend it somewhere between 1 month and 6 months. And then we revisit that again when we come back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the United States flirting with default. What's at stake? What's at risk if we go there? Maybe even if we just get close. Austin Goolsbee is with us from Chicago's Booth School of Business, University of Chicago. Alan Auerbach is with us, professor of economics, UC Berkeley. Austin Goolsbee was the president's chief economic advisor in the thick of the last debt ceiling crisis. Lots of talk all over today, lots in the air. If you're listening in the evening, we may have or be on the way towards some kind of six-week deal here. We'll see. Jack Lew testifying today, saying he's been warning, don't go there, Treasury Secretary. He was talking about it also with CNN on Sunday.
I'm telling you that on the 17th, we run out of our ability to borrow, and Congress is playing with fire. If they don't extend the debt limit, we have a very, very short window of time before those scenarios start to be played out.
Rand Paul talking with NBC's Nightly News yesterday, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul saying not to worry.
I'm not advocating we go through the debt ceiling deadline, but what I am saying is if you go through it, you will not default, and that leaders in our country should reassure the world's markets we will not default.
Just reassure the world's markets we'll be fine. On Tuesday, Harvey Eisen, CEO of Wright Investor Services, told Bloomberg News that Congress would be, quoting him here, lunatics to let a default happen. Therefore, he finds it unthinkable, but the game is on.
It is so inconceivable that these lunatics would do that, that I can't even comprehend it. But don't believe me. Listen to the likes of Warren Buffett. Listen to the people who really know. This is all gamesmanship, showmanship, nonsense, in my opinion.
And we're talking about potentially a week from today, potentially 6 weeks from today. Alan Auerbach, lots of response from our listeners here online. And here's one of the first ones that came in. And just Judy says, at 55, I am terrified for my 401k. Presumably, she's got some of that in the stock market. Is that reasonable to be worried about that as we sit here today, Alan?
Yes.
Is it reasonable to be terrified?
It is reasonable to be terrified. The clip you just played, where someone said it's the lunatic to be thinking about doing this. Well, that's right. But if people are giving credible evidence that they're lunatics, then maybe they are, and that is certainly cause for concern.
The markets have been down over the last week, but not that much. What do you make of the relative quietude in the stock market then, Alan?
I think that suggests that the sentiment of the market is that some sort of deal, perhaps a short-run deal, will be worked out and the U.S. will not default. Of course, that can change very quickly.
You mean market sentiment?
Yeah, market sentiment could, we could have some sort of indication from Washington that the current deal that's being discussed is falling through and we're actually haven't made any progress, and the market could fall very sharply immediately.
Austin Goolsbee, you've been in the White House in the thick of not the same, but a similar kind of negotiation. Now we've got this new set of politics, the Tea Party much more in the forefront even than last time. How do you look at the at the possibility here, the prospect for some kind of agreement today, in the next week, in the next 6 weeks?
Well, the one thing I would say is your view that this is fundamentally different from all other times, I don't know if I agree with that. It felt very similar to what the discussion was happening in 2011, and it seems like we're on a bit, as I say, this treadmill that, you know, we're gonna have a hostage negotiation, but we're gonna have it over and over. And I
think John Boehner was just as much in the grip of this Tea Party faction that's willing to press this very far last time, as deep.
For sure. Mm-hmm. The Tea Party had just won. You know, this was right after their resounding victory at the midterm elections. I think the difference this time, which just makes me even more pessimistic that they would be able to come up with a true deal that was other than just a short run, push it out and have the same fight again, is the Republicans are divided. So Democrats to all agree that they think this is an illegitimate way to have the debate, and they don't want to go along with it. The Republicans are themselves divided. You have some group of Republicans who say this is too negative and this will have too negative an impact on the economy. Let's stop it. Let's not fight over the debt ceiling. You got a group that says let's demand the end of Obamacare or postponement of Obamacare. You got one that's kind of more the Tea Party group.
Yep.
You've got one group of conservatives, Paul Ryan and others, kind of the budget conservatives, who they want to make it about entitlement reform. And then you've got kind of a mass of Republicans with John Boehner it does not seem to be about any specific issue or ideology. They just want to be seen that they got a victory or they got something, and a lot of their concentration is just on short-run spending. Let's just reduce the amount of short-run spending. As long as the Republicans cannot agree amongst themselves, and most of them think that what the others are doing on any given issue is wrong, I think it's going to be hard to come up with any agreement. And that makes me a little nervous. But at the least, if there's an agreement, it feels to me like all it's going to be is move it down the road.
Here was John Boehner. This was on Tuesday, saying, you know, hey, we've been here before, kind of a let's chill out message. Here's the House Speaker.
When it comes to the debt limit, I agree with the president. We should pay our bills. I didn't come here to shut down the government. I certainly didn't come here to default on our debt. But when it comes to the debt limit, again, over the last 40 years, 27 times the debt limit has been used to carry significant policy changes that would, in fact, reduce spending and put us on a saner fiscal path.
But not everybody is so confident that's going to happen, even if there's movement toward it. This was just yesterday in Washington. Oliver Blanchard, chief economic counselor and director for the International Monetary Fund, saying you default on its debt and you're going to see recovery would turn into a recession or worse.
The effects of any failure to repay the debt would be felt right away, leading to potentially major disruptions in financial markets, both in the United States and abroad.
Alan Auerbach, you're watching from California, but you know Washington. Last time, when Austin Goolsbee was in the thick of it, it was a close thing. Our credit rating was knocked down, even though we got a deal at the last minute. Do you see comparable chemistry this time, Alan, that will get us, whether it's in the next week or the next 6 weeks, to a deal? Or do you see a subtle, I mean, it doesn't take much to shift the weight of these political standoffs. Do you see this as a thornier challenge?
It strikes me as thornier, as Austin suggested. I think there's more division within the Republican Party. It was already there last time, and I think it's bigger this time. I think another problem is that there's not really anything that substantive that's being fought about. We're not going to see a defunding of the Affordable Care Act. That's not going to happen. And we're also not going to get any meaningful fiscal reforms in terms of putting the country on a more stable fiscal footing over the next 6 weeks or the next 6 months. It's just not going to happen. These are, in the best of times, these kinds of adjustments would require a lot of planning and a lot of discussion. So ultimately, we're really not talking about anything There are not underlying policy differences that can be resolved and pave the way to a an agreement over the debt limit and funding the government. It's entirely political fight. It doesn't really have anything to do with the underlying policy differences, which in turn makes it hard to predict what will happen.
I mean, we'll see if that's true. If all this is just about rhetoric and everything is put at risk because of that and posturing, boy, there could be some angry voters before it's all over. Ross in Middlebury, Vermont. What do you think, Ross? You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering, since the Constitution specifically authorizes Congress to coin money, why doesn't Congress, instead of borrowing money from the Fed and paying interest, just print the money they need to keep the government open? Maybe guest could answer that.
But you still have to raise the debt ceiling to do that, right, Austin? Even if you...
Well, you wouldn't need to raise the debt ceiling because the debt ceiling is just a limit on the amount of Treasury bonds outstanding.
Oh, I see. So if you just print it,
now,
well, what
I
about it then?
I don't think the Constitution is quite as clear that Congress could print money. I just have this image in my head of Congress coming in with rolls of quarters, trying to pay off the bills with change. But I think fundamentally the financial markets rely on U.S. Treasuries. I don't think with it, my read of the evidence is we would not be able to get around this by minting trillion-dollar platinum coins and things like that. There have been people trying to come up with, if we really came to an emergency, why don't we pull out the following stops? Anything you were relying on Congress to do, they wouldn't do. I mean, if Congress were willing to avoid this problem, they would just...
We'd avoid it already.
It right now.
Yeah.
So if Congress has to coin money, I don't think that will work.
There's been some attitude of bring it on. It creates a crisis, and a crisis might create a breakthrough. Martin Wolf joins us right now, chief economics commentator for the Financial Times out of London, author of Fixing Global Finance. Martin Wolf, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
I'm pleased to be here. I should note that I'm actually in New York at the moment.
Terrific. Great to have you. How about the way the rest of the world is watching this? It can look nuts to a lot of Americans. What about the rest of the planet?
Incomprehensible, I think, is perhaps as good a description as any. The details of American policymaking are lost on most people. I suspect they're lost on most Americans, but they're certainly lost on most foreigners. So they don't really understand how this is possible. And remember that, so far as I know, there is no other country which, in addition to deciding how much tax to raise and how much it wants to spend, also has to agree on the debt, the borrowing that is implied by these two earlier decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So the debt ceiling is itself an incomprehensible piece of legal machinery for anybody else. Beyond that, I suppose the general view is that we assume that the U.S. will sort this out without doing something completely insane.
Who's the we there, Martin? The rest of the world?
I'm speaking with the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you asked me to
mm-hmm.
do.
Yes.
And that in the end, the U.S. will avoid doing anything completely crazy, like defaulting. But I suppose the confidence in that may not be quite as great as it was a few weeks ago.
We're looking at the big picture here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here we are now, just days, or maybe if there's some kind of breakthrough deal for a little while, 6 weeks away. Is there a risk, Martin, of suddenly a consensus forming around the world? You know what? The U.S. really is in crazy town, and this doesn't work for us. We're out of here. Maybe we go to the Chinese renminbi, or I don't know what happens. Is there a risk of just saying, forget it, we're out of here?
I think it's fairly unlikely that you can imagine something as profound as that. But it depends very much on what actually happens in the U.S. If the U.S. does as it has now done for decades, actually, and namely keep in the end rolling this forward so the debt ceiling is in fact raised,
mm-hmm.
I think people will be reasonably relaxed because the assumption is the U.S. will fix it. Then there are two other possibilities. Let's suppose, which seems to me possible, that there's an interruption for a few hours and This creates absolute mayhem in the markets, and we're beginning to see just a little sign of that in the T-bill market. That, and then the U.S. really pulls out the stops and agreement is reached, which looks reasonably solid. Then I think people will probably not get too hysterical, but that's a probably, not a certainly. Mm-hmm. If, however, interruption in payments were significant and lasting and no speedy resolution were reached, then the U.S. would clearly pay a price for it. I don't think we're going to switch to the renminbi because it's not available, and the euro doesn't look too great. So the U.S. has a huge advantage, colossal advantage, that all its competitors look very poor. But if the U.S. really decides to destroy its own credibility, of course, it will pay a price for it, even if the others aren't really going to replace it. It will just pay a price.
You've watched the U.S. for a long time. The world consensus has been for decades now that the U.S. won't do something like this. As you say, the assumption is there that it'll be worked out. Do you see any a change in the politics this time? Is there some worry in the back of your mind that maybe we're on new ground here or not ultimately?
Yes. I've followed the U.S. fairly closely for, I suppose, 50 years, and I've lived here for 10. Mm-hmm. And it's always been politics here are a great circus and a wonderful sort of display of human characteristics and foibles. So a lot of it isn't new.
Great.
But it seems to me that the venom here and the language that is being used, quite a number of representatives in the majority party in the House saying, well, maybe a default wouldn't be too bad. In fact, maybe it would just cut the government back to the way we want to see it. This sort of language seems to me to be new. And the willingness to contemplate what I would have thought was unthinkable seems to be more general. And in the Republican Party, I think there is a sense, again in the outside world, that what we consider the reasonable elements are being overwhelmed by some really very weird ones. So I think it looks worse in this respect than it has in the past, but it's difficult to judge just how much worse.
Let's go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm so glad that someone finally mentioned that it's the Republicans, because I think we do a disservice to, in particular, low-information voters here in America when we just say Congress and we just say the government. No, let's point them out. It is the House Republicans that's causing this government shutdown. It's the House Republicans that's walking us right up to the edge of insanity, which would be a default. And I'm comforted by the Gallup poll that came out yesterday that the Republicans have their lowest polling ever in that poll, 28% approval rating. So
but,
I believe.
But Carl, the Republicans say all the president has to do is talk with us, and we'll get through this.
And that's all the Republicans have to do is stop putting poison pills. And maybe the man will talk to him. That's all the Republicans had to do was not walk away from the grand bargain in 2011. And this is something, like I said, the low-information voters aren't paying attention to. And when media just say the government or Congress, they confuse them. Just say, as the gentleman just said a minute ago, that it's the House Republicans that is causing all these problems in our country over the past 4 or 5 years. The venom is coming from them. It's pure hatred.
Well, it certainly is a new strain of chemistry here in our politics that we're seeing right now. Austin Goolsbee says a familiar dynamic, but there's a different amplitude somehow to my ear on it, maybe a different risk as well. Carl, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the United States flirting with default. What's at stake? What's at risk if we go there? If we just get close? Martin Wolf joins us this hour, chief economics commentator for the Financial Times. Austin Goolsbee is here from University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He was in the White House during the last debt ceiling crisis. And Alan Auerbach is with us from UC Berkeley at the Burt Center for Tax Policy and Public Finance. They're economists in California. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Are we right now driving ourselves, the world, toward an economic catastrophe? Wild sell-offs, bank runs, out-of-business signs? How do we stop this moving train? Maybe there's an effort to put brakes on right now. President Obama has said he would sign a short-term extension of the debt ceiling only if it didn't contain any other language that he opposes. He wants Congress, he has said, he wants Congress to send him a bill unconditionally ending the partial government shutdown as well. Republicans have said they want deficit reduction and cuts in government programs, including the Affordable Care Act, to be in something like this. Now, Gallup polls out today. Our caller there, Carl, was right. Both sides, numbers down, Republicans and Democrats, but Republicans down more, down to a record low 28% public approval rating. In that context, news today of an emerging movement here to extend the borrowing cap for 4 weeks or 6 weeks and try to jumpstart talks on a broader budget deal that could replace cuts to defense and domestic agency budgets to cuts to benefit programs like Medicare and reforms to loopholes in the tax code. The talk so far is that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is not in that. We will see what emerges by the end of the day today. But the risk behind it all, this default scenario playing out all too vividly now as a possibility in this country and around the world. Let's hear from our listeners, Mike in Troy, Alabama. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think there's also all kinds of opportunity costs to this back and forth game. The speaker says it's not a game, but it is a game. And while the risk of financial ruin are great, we're not discussing and working out long-term solutions to our debt. We're not addressing things like climate change, which could cause the demise of millions of people around the world. We're just not doing other things we need to be doing while we continuously stay in this loop, this game.
Yeah, Mike, I appreciate your call. Alan Auerbach, let's say we've got a four-week or a six-week extension on the table. Can something happen in that time, or are we just right back here at Thanksgiving time?
Well, surely something can happen. It strikes me as implausible that any kind of solution, sensible solution to our long-term problems can happen in a 4 to 6 week or 6 month or 1 year period. We did try this the last time around in the summer of 2011, establishing something called a super committee in Congress that was supposed to come up with more permanent solutions to our budget situation. It failed. That led to what we have now called the sequester, which is a broad brush cut in government spending that nobody's very happy with and doesn't really deal at all with our long-term problems. One of the things that makes me pessimistic about the current situation is even if Congress decides that the Republicans in the House decide that it's not in their interest to allow a default to happen and pass a clean short-term extension of the debt limit and opening of the government, we're going to be back in the same place whenever that expires without any real hope of any kind of serious progress. And the politics will be the same then as it is now.
Martin Wolf, our caller, asks about opportunity costs here. I mean, you watch a lot of different countries around the world and their politics. Many depend on the stability of the U.S. dollar, the U.S. economy for that matter. Is there a point at which not just faith in the dollar, but faith in the governance of the United States starts to undermine this country's economic strength, standing, you name it, Martin?
I think it's obvious that in certain respects, and this is a double-sided answer, the prestige of the United States as a sort of guarantor of the global order, both politically and economically, has been pretty seriously damaged over, let's say, the last decade or so. And it's really pretty easy to see why. Look at what happened on the military side. Look at the huge financial crisis for which many people continue to largely to blame the U.S. And then look at this. So it's clear that people around the world, I think, compared with the 1990s, when the U.S. really looked wonderful shape, the winner of the Cold War, clearly the prestige has been damaged. At the same time, I would emphasize very much as a European that in handling the financial crisis when it happened, the U.S. administration and the Federal Reserve and other regulatory bodies, but principally these two, really dealt with it by comparison with, say, the Europeans or indeed the Japanese, who've been in mire for 20 years, remarkably effective.
Are you saying the Bush administration or Obama or both?
Both, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's strange enough, Hank Paulson is the man I would give more credit for, though he made many mistakes. But from the time the crisis really hit through the Obama administration, The U.S. was more effective, and it showed the immense power and capacity of the federal government when it really is forced to do something as a system. So in that respect, it looks pretty impressive. And then you come back to this political mess, and one doesn't really know what to make of it. Is it a circus? Is it a show which will ultimately continue, the game will go on, or will it lead to something more serious? But in general, I think prestige has been undermined, there's no doubt. But at the same time, people still basically trust the U.S. They trust the U.S. more than any other important political entity in the world. There's no doubt about that. And the question is, will that last?
Talk about a valuable status that we do not want to fritter away, though there's pressure on it already, as you say. Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator with the Financial Times. Martin, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure.
Let's go to Tracy in Shelburne, Vermont. Tracy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. He made a great point. People do look up to us as being the leaders and kind of knowing what we're doing. I think we need to stop pointing fingers. There's a lot of people that are without jobs right now or without an income. I think that we need to get this fixed. But going forward, I think that we haven't got a handle on how we spend our funds. And I think that needs to be looked at because, don't get me wrong, there are people out there that need assistance. I understand that. But assistance is a key word where if you are on assistance and you don't work and at the end of the year you file a tax return, these people are getting money back, up to $3,000, when really it's the government paying their rent, their food, whatever it is. Again, I have no problem with that. But that tax returns, shouldn't that go back to the government? I mean, that's millions of dollars that we back in our pocket.
But what about all the jobs that have gone away? What about people who have not been able to find a way to feed and house themselves in this economy, Tracy?
Oh, absolutely. No, I understand. But again, keyword is assistance. I walk around and I see so many people they're hiring, they're looking for help. Where if we could just, again, assist these people and the money that we assist them with, if that goes back to the government at the end of the year, we can keep borrowing money.
No, I get it. But you're saying let them find a way. It's been hard to find a way for a lot of people, but I know this concern is out there. Alan Auerbach, what about the way we spend our money in this country? If we could sit down in a level-headed way, can you see room for consensus on our spending, our long-term fiscal situation here, Alan?
One of the things that most people don't understand is that most of what the U.S. government spends now, and even more so in the future, goes toward a few major so-called entitlement programs. Right now, if you exclude interest from the federal budget, about half of what we spend, what the federal government spend, goes toward three programs: Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. In 15 years, that's going to be substantially more than 50%. So when we talk about getting the government under control or reducing the size of government or any other term used to describe what the objective is, we're talking about these three programs. Sure, the defense budget is big, but the defense budget is small compared to these three programs. The rest of the government is tiny compared to these three programs. So it all has to center on this as well as reform on the tax side. All of the discussion that's going on in Washington relates to other things, which I think highlights the fact that the discussion not only is currently quite counterproductive and with little progress being made, but it's also about the wrong things.
Austin, last time out, I mean, both sides talk about finding savings in the entitlement programs. The president said he was ready to work on that front, but he said, let's also raise taxes on the most affluent in this country because they've done very well indeed over the last, since the recovery. Is that the major sticking point here, Austin, still?
Yeah, definitely. That was what the grand bargain fell apart on. The fiscal commission produced a recommendation that they do about 2 or 3 to 1 spending cuts to new revenues. And there were sitting House Republicans on that fiscal commission, and they voted unanimously against it. And it was precisely because it had revenue. So I'm pretty pessimistic. If they have a short-term extension to the debt ceiling on the grounds that they want to have 6 weeks of negotiations about entitlement reforms, I don't see how that doesn't end up 6 weeks from now in exactly the spot we are here, in which they can't agree because the fundamentals have been pushing us away for this, you know, at least since the 2010 midterms, the fundamentals on the political side have been pushing us away from the let's all get together and make a deal and everybody gets 50% of what they wanted, which is kind of the older budget tradition of the U.S.
We're looking at the big crisis in front of the country right now, potential short-term way out of it, but there it still sits in default, we're told, a week from today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Alan Auerbach, you're a serious fiscal conservative. You want these long-term numbers fixed. Many people do. Meanwhile, here we are, have been on the verge of something that could be calamitous, we're told. I mean, Warren Buffett saying this is a nuclear bomb if we go to the default. Is it crazy town, Austin's word, to go there over the issue or over an insistence on zero new revenues? I mean, you want the deficit addressed. Do you think revenues ought to be part of that picture?
Oh, I think revenues has to be part of the picture. Given the demographic change we have in the U.S. and the increasing costs of providing health care, there's no plausible way that we're going to solve this entirely on the spending side. And that's just a statement of fact. That's not a political statement. And what we should be doing is thinking about how we can change our tax system to make it a better, more efficient, fairer tax system that can give us a little bit more revenue each year to help with solution to the long-run budget problem. And simply saying no, 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 no is going to pretty much leave us with no chance of making any kind of progress at all.
Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to share an observation, see what your guests think about this. Mm-hmm. It seems impossible to understand where we are now without looking at how we got here. And it seems impossible to understand how we got here without looking at the Tea Party. And it really seems impossible to look at the Tea Party without understanding that it was, in my estimation, not a grassroots movement, but really got a kickstart from a handful of very, very wealthy people who can trace their beginnings really back to Goldwater's desire to really gut entitlement programs. And it, to me, it seems like a clear line. It's very clear. It's etched in stone. And I'm just wondering what other people think about that.
Yeah, you see big money puppeteers here. Austin Goolsbee, when you were in the White House in the midst of this, looking out across the land, is that what you saw? Or did you also see Americans, you know, in the Tea Party rank and file, origins, whatever they may be, saying, enough?
Look, I don't know. I'm not a political philosopher or anything. I'm just a policy guy. So I don't know the origins of these things. I do know that it's a little more, it strikes me as a little more complicated than that the Tea Party's main motivation is to cut entitlements. I know there are people saying that on the Republican side, but you've seen this big effort on the part of the Tea Party in this debate not to make it about entitlements, but instead to make it about the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And so, as I've said before, I think that that has created a major complication in what we had kind of a normal periodic episodes of these flashpoint crises over the debt ceiling, but we sort of understood what the nature of the argument always was. It was, you know, what's the government spending, and they want cuts, and how many cuts for extending the debt limit. What made this different is the Republicans cannot agree amongst themselves what they even want, and each side thinks the other one's wrong for wanting to do it on Obamacare, and they think it's wrong for doing it on entitlement. So I think it's gotten a little more complicated, even if that were the origin.
Of course, some in that camp kind of pushing to describe the Affordable Care Act as entitlement. Craig in Onalaska, Wisconsin. Craig, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, do you see any possibility of these radical Tea Party Republicans being primaried by more moderate Republicans because of the damage that they could possibly be doing to the country by defaulting?
I mean, the question stands there. We may be moving out of the expertise of my guest today, Craig, but certainly if there's major, major damage, there's going to be a major battle over where to pin the blame, and it could end up there. And Alan Auerbach, here we are on a day when there may be movement here, when we have Speaker Boehner speaking today and talk of a 4 to 6 week extension. How much does that put your heart at ease on all this, Alan?
Not a lot. I'm quite concerned about the political dynamics in the U.S. right now, and of course it will be an improvement if we resolve the current situation and don't default on the national debt and open the government. But we'll be back again in 6 weeks or 6 months or whenever this incipient agreement runs out. And I don't know, certainly until after the next election, and perhaps not even then, that there will be any change in the political configuration in Washington to give us a more productive government.
And the ongoing risk to the U.S. economy in that?
Well, of course. Having a government that's not operating and having capital markets possibility of default that's not good for the economy. Many economists have been arguing that we need to do more to spur the economy and not move the way we have been in the last few weeks.
Scary time, amazing week, maybe amazing day, we'll see. And then more to come. Alan Auerbach is professor of economics and law at the University of California and director of the Birch Center for Tax Policy and Public Finance there. Alan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Austin Goolsbee in Chicago, professor now of economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He was there last time. Austin Goolsbee, thank you very much for your perspective today.
Thank you.
Listeners, join us tomorrow. We will round up all the news of the week. Thanks for being here today. Good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.